House come to order if members can take their seats.
This budget is a huge job maker, and the number one solution to economic insecurity is a job.
Hungry children can't learn, and it's our responsibility to try to help.
Equality and opportunity.
I believe most people are here because they want to do some good.
Welcome to a brand new episode of Capital Ideas. This is the podcast where members of the majority Democrats in the Washington State House of Representatives sit down at the Capitol and talk about ideas. They generally do it one at a time, and today's idea maker is Representative Davina Duer. Davina lives in Bothell in the 1st Legislative District. She's an architect by trade, a member of the House since 2020, and chair of the House Local Government Committee. We talked on Friday, February 14th, 2025, and it went like this. Welcome to Capital Ideas again, Representative Davina Duer from District Number 1.
Thank you, Dan. It's nice to be with you again.
It's been 2 years since the last time we talked. You were chair of the House Local Government Committee at that time. That hasn't changed, has it?
It has not, but my committee has changed.
What's different now in the portfolio of the local government committee?
The local government sort of finance picture has been pulled out of my jurisdiction and put fully into finance, in large part because of the fiscal challenges we have this year. We agree that it was important not to have two stops.
I will interject here and just explain to people that finance down here means revenue.
Right.
Could be taxes, yeah. Could be fees, but in any case,
revenue.
Your committee is not responsible now for generating income.
Correct, or even reviewing those bills. Generally, we would review the policy around it anyway, not so much the income part. So that is out of my committee, and now we have added permitting and building codes and energy codes and a larger portion of the Growth Management Act portfolio as well.
Well, it's interesting that you said permitting right here at the top of the conversation, because I have a note here from our last conversation where we did talk about some permitting issues. And I was just going to ask you, in the last 2 years, has permitting improved? And by that, I mean the process, the red tape, the time involved. In general, I know that every permitting process is going to be different. But overall, has there been some improvement? Because people gripe about that a lot.
There's different types of permitting, so that, you know, there's building permitting, and then there's all of the adjacent sort of permitting. Parts of it have improved. Some of the bills that we've seen that put in timelines haven't been fully implemented yet, so we're still waiting to see what the results of those pieces of legislation are, but we continue to kind of try to whittle away and streamline things. Unfortunately, one of the bigger problems is workforce and staffing that cities have around permitting desks. That continues to be a problem. And unfortunately, that does not have a quick solution, because it's, you know, training people up and getting students interested in a career and that sort of thing. And many of them don't even really know that that's a career option. So what we're finding, we had a work session actually on the first day of our committee around permitting and workforce particularly, and cities continue to hire from out of state and bring them in, and then they end up being hired away by another city or the state or whatnot. And so it ends up being somewhat of an endless musical chairs. So a lot of what cities are doing now is trying to bring people up through the ranks within the city and promote from within. Yeah, that continues to be a challenge that's a little bit hard to find a quick solution to. But I think generally in terms of permitting, building permits and whatnot, we continue to whittle away at some of the issues. And, you know, a lot of times it takes a couple of years to implement the bills that are passed. So like 5290, which was a big bill that put permit timelines at 120 days, that's getting close to being fully implemented. But the unfortunate thing is all of these things take time, and we want things to happen right away.
And I think almost without exception, all the rules for these permits were established at some point for a good reason.
Right.
We hear people say, well, we should get rid of permitting, or we should cut the number of permits in half required to build home, therefore we could solve the housing crisis tomorrow, but they're not just there to be roadblocks. They're there to establish good practices.
Right. Like, we all want clean water and clean air and roads that work. Unfortunately, what happens a lot of times is we're putting regulation upon regulation and building in complexity because of the nature of our work being in a session with a timeline. And often we're too impatient to maybe take the time to do sort of the backward glance at, like, how could this work better and the pieces fit together in a more integrative way. And so we end up building in complexity unintentionally.
What other committees are you on other than local government?
So I'm on the Environment and Energy Committee and on the Transportation Committee. And I've been on all of those, I think, 5 years now. I haven't moved around a whole lot, but I find that they're all intersectional on the same issues, like environment impacts, transpo, and local government. And all of them, to me, are part of a larger picture of, you know, the landscape that I'm interested in. And they play off of each other. And I like that. I like looking at all of the aspects of them and how they impact each other.
And let me get you to do kind of a 1,000-foot picture right now of how your background, which is as an architect, intersects with all of these.
That's exactly it, right? So local government, a lot of the big portion of the portfolio of local government is land use. And land use is impacted by transportation, because land use is, how do we use our land? What do we build on it? How high do we build? You know, how densely do we build? What do we build? And that impacts traffic patterns. And then, you know, all of that impacts the environment. The more, you know, transportation, I think, is 45% of our greenhouse gas emissions, and I care very deeply about the environment. And so to me, they all have to work together optimally so that we make the smallest footprint on the planet. Once you learn that and understand that at a policy level, you can't unlearn it. You can't unsee it. I was just speaking to a chamber group, and we were talking about some of the challenges around housing and transportation and all these things. And I pointed out, like, we're at the point in time where there's no easy solution. Civilization, turns out, is very expensive, and our population is growing rapidly, and we have not been building enough housing. And we're now suffering the consequences of having stymied some housing. And we have children that we would all love to have live in the same state as us. And my children are certainly thinking, I will never be able to afford $1 million house. That is certainly not the future that I want, where my kids can't live anywhere near me. And so I'm very highly motivated by thinking about the next generation, both, you know, when it comes to housing and when it comes to the environment.
Let's talk about the environment for a minute, because you've got a couple of bills, more than a couple, but a couple that I have zeroed in on here on a list of your legislation for this session that are germane to this conversation. One has to do with hydrofluorocarbons, and another has to do with something that I think I talked to you a few weeks ago about, which is, for want of a better term, labeling houses with their expected energy draws. Mm-hmm. That's not a very good way to put it, so I will toss it over to you.
Well, thank you. Yeah, the home energy labeling bill, I liken to the sticker that is on a car in the car lot when you go to, you know, purchase a brand new car. You know, just by looking at that sticker on the window, how many miles per gallon it's going to cost you to operate that car. And so you get a sense of what your outgoing, you know, costs will be. A house is the largest single purchase you'll ever make. And yet we don't have that same ability to and transparency when we buy a house to know what is it going to cost us every month, and what are the impacts on the environment for whatever the heating system is for that building. And so what this bill seeks to do is, it's just merely allowing cities to require that a home energy audit be done on a house when it's put up for sale. And it's, you know, roughly $150, $200 cost, but it allows the purchaser to see what the cost is for that home over the year. what the greenhouse gas emissions are on that. And additionally, which I find very useful for people, especially first-time homeowners, is what are the big and small interventions I might do to bring those costs down? I think it's very common sense.
Are there people right now who have their shingles out as energy auditors?
There aren't. So the bill postpones the implementation for a year to allow people to get a certificate. It's a very simple certificate to get. And we're finding in other places that have implemented this law that building inspectors can easily add that on to their list of services they provide. But it's fairly simple. So not even just building inspectors, anyone could take the courses and understand how to do it.
So you're creating jobs.
In a sense, yeah. I mean, I don't know how many jobs. When we were hearing in committee about the implementation, some cities said very quickly they had at least 3 to 5 people. And that's about all you really need for an average size city to perform these audits. So,
the other bill I mentioned just a second ago is House Bill 1462, which has to do with hydrofluorocarbons, which used to be Freon, I suppose. Then it became some other chemical name that I don't know. And now you're hoping that we transition to a third. But in the meantime, this has to do with using recycled or reclaimed refrigerants. Is that
correct? This bill is meant to actually ease the transition that's already going to happen because of a federal ban on hydrofluorocarbons. Hydrofluorocarbons, by their very nature, absorb heat. And so you can imagine if carbon dioxide absorbs heat in the atmosphere, a hydrofluorocarbon can absorb 2,000 to 4,000 times that of carbon dioxide, which has a pretty damaging effect on the atmosphere. So there's going to be a ban in place. And so we're trying to move ahead of that ban to open market signals for reclaimed refrigerant because there's equipment out there that uses the existing hydrofluorocarbon. And they have, you know, sometimes a very long lifespan. And we certainly don't want to force industry to have to replace all of their equipment when it still has maybe 10, 20 years of use left in it. But we need to make sure that there's enough reclaimed refrigerant available that they can continue to do that. And so this bill actually is an attempt to try to ease that transition. And by banning hydrofluorocarbons in this state and requiring ahead of that state facilities to use reclaimed, we can make a market signal that we need more reclaimed refrigerant and get that market going in order to ease that transition.
You have a bill here that you're sponsoring, House Bill 1254, for those keeping score, that is entitled Wildland-Urban Interface. And I find that real interesting because I kind of live on the interface between wildlands and a semi-urban environment. What does this bill do?
It's a pretty controversial bill because we unanimously passed a bill. I don't know if it had the exact same title, but we passed a bill last year which took the authority for implementing WUI and adopting WUI away from the State Building Code Council and put it in the hands of the legislature. There was a lot of controversy because some maps came out the DNR had prepared of the wildland urban interface in the state. It was a map of the interface, but was taken as a map of risk. And you can imagine the fear that it caused when people began to worry about having to cut down a lot of trees for defensible space. Because of those maps, I think there became a fear of the process and a distrust of that process. And so that bill, I passed it out of committee last year in my local government committee because the maps had to be changed and that work had to be started, but there wasn't time to really have a conversation about what the process for adopting that code should look like. And so I brought the bill back this year because the State Building Code Council asked that it be treated like every other code that they are tasked with implementing. Last year, it was basically they were told you can only adopt these portions of the bill, and you can't adopt updates, and you can't make amendments. Now, as an architect, one of the things that I did for many years was I would get the updated building codes, and then I would put them in a binder, and then I'd get the Washington State amendments and the changes that the State Building Code Council made specific to Washington. So this is something they do on all the other codes that they get, but we were denying them that ability to make that change. And I felt that it was very inconsistent and really unhelpful to give the legislature, who is certainly not a body of experts on wildland urban interface or building, the authority for this particular code. And then after watching all those fires in the wildland urban interface in California right before session started, I really began to worry, if we don't pass this code and do the work in the correct process with the experts looking at it, will we end up having a crisis with homeowners insurance in this state? And so I felt really strongly that I needed to rebuild that trust by bringing everyone into the conversation. What should this process look like? How do we rebuild trust? And how do we get to the best possible outcome? And so I started that conversation. I've had a lot of stakeholders come in, fire service and cities and counties and DNR. And it's actually so far been a pretty good process. People have made suggestions on how to change the process. I had a meeting. Everyone talked about their suggestions. Nobody disagreed with anyone else's input. And so we'll be executing that bill on Friday out of my committee. And I'm sure there'll be continued conversations and changes, but I feel very hopeful that we can do something, because I feel it's so important that we make sure the process is in the right hands and goes through the eyes of experts.
Your House Bill 1015 about energy labeling for residences clearly has to do with, among other things, energy. You're also on the Environment and Energy Committee here. What's going on in that committee? I know you're not the chair, but you certainly are an active member in there.
Oh, gosh. It's such a big committee with so many bills. I think some of the things that we're wrangling with are that one of the big things is the need for transmission and the fact that we just don't have enough transmission to move the amount of energy that we need for the future. You know, a lot of the energy source is out of the east side of the state with wind and solar, and getting it over to the you know, west side of the state. And then when we have power outages and whatnot, you know, we have interchanges with other states, but there are points where the connection between states is not as robust as it needs to be for us to share power in times of emergencies. So there's a bit of a backup, I guess you would say, that needs to be taken care of. And you know, some of the things we're looking at are increasing capacity on existing lines, but a lot of what we need to look at is how to move that energy and how to ease the right-of-ways and permitting processes and whatnot to make that happen. And how do we best provide for the energy that we need for the future while also protecting the environment and considering local control and so many different factors. It's quite a complex problem.
This kind of goes back to what we talked about a few minutes ago, which is there aren't a whole lot of simple problems down here.
No.
So the solutions tend to be pretty complicated.
They do.
Getting away from active bills right now for a minute, I just want to ask you a question that just occurred to me. This is your sixth session as a member of the House of Representatives. Cast yourself back to that first year, the first time we talked, and tell me what's changed in your head now over the past 6 years about this job. When you came in, you had been a member of City Council, so you certainly knew about legislating, but this is a whole different fishbowl down here.
Oh my gosh, what's changed? I think when you're new, you have a certain naivete about how things work and endless energy and impatience. You have this idea that you're going to change the world overnight. And since that first session, I've had several bills that took me 4 years to pass and some that I have yet to pass. And so I've had to learn to embrace the process. And while I say that, that doesn't mean I'm any less impatient or any more excited when I get the next call that's like, we have a problem with your bill. It's really hard sometimes to, you know, to kind of sit back and just accept the slowness of the process. But I've had experiences where, with my refrigerants bill, actually, last year it came so close to passing. Of course, I was really disappointed because a lot of work goes into getting it all the way to Senate Ways and Means. But I will say we stepped back and we worked a lot over the interim and reached out to industry and completely changed the bill and how to get to the same goal. I hate to admit it, but it's a better bill.
And that slowness is kind of built into the process purposely, the way I understand it.
Yeah.
It's a way to kind of whittle off the rough edges of things by the time they're really ready to be served, which is a totally mixed metaphor, but...
No, it's true. It is. I think it's very true. So many things here remind you that you don't know what you don't know. And that's why it's so important to do the process of reaching out to people that are impacted by your bill or are going to have to implement that bill or have a different perspective, because that's how you learn where the problems are. And that's where learning to be patient is so important, because it's frustrating and sometimes maddening and you might want to pull your hair out. But better that than passing something that just completely misses the mark or misses a really important angle that you didn't even conceive of.
That's where the term unintended consequences comes
into
play.
That's right. Yeah.
Davina, I had to wrestle with your legislative assistant to get 30 minutes here. We've been talking for 29 minutes and 35 seconds, so I know it's about time to let you go to your next thing, whatever that may be. However, before we go, as I always do, I want to ask, how do you want to close out this conversation?
There's a lot going on in the world right now outside of this Washington. You know, it puts everything that I do here in a kind of different context than ever before. We have a lot of fiscal challenges this year, and I just want people to know that we continue to do our work here, but it doesn't mean that we're not paying attention and we don't care about what's happening outside of these walls. And we know that we're going to have to make some really hard decisions, and that I hope that, you know, my constituents and people listening understand that we don't do anything lightly. There are sure to be disappointed people at the end of this session, because there are going to be painful cuts and there are going to be probably painful revenue options out there. And we're all human and we all care deeply about our communities. And so I hope that amongst the disappointment that there is some grace and understanding.
And it may help that situation by people remembering that some of the most disappointed people will be members of the state legislature.
Yeah, I was told recently that in 2008, at the end of that experience, that the hallways were filled with legislators and community members crying. And so that might be in our future. I'm hoping not, but it sure feels like it's going to be painful.
We'll find out in a few months. Thank you, Representative Davina Duer from Bothell. That's in Washington's first legislative district, which I guess means it's the best. I really enjoyed talking to you again, Davina. Thanks for coming by.
Thanks, Dan. I always enjoy our talks, and I hope that you have a great day and that session doesn't end the way I'm worried it will.
We'll see. That last 20 minutes, that's as good an argument as I can think of for why you ought to subscribe to Capital Ideas. You don't hear this on the radio. It's not in the newspaper stories you read, but this is the real thing. Here's how you can subscribe. Just open the House Democratic Caucus website at housedemocrats.wa.gov, and at the top, click on the media button. In the menu that drops down, click on Capital Ideas Podcast. In addition to opening a page where there are maybe 100 previous editions of Capital Ideas, there are links to places where you can subscribe. It's easy. And of course, you can just go straight to wherever you get your podcasts and search for us. Capital with an O, Ideas. That's it. The reason you should do this is your state government. What happens here matters now more than ever, and in every episode, you're going to meet people who are working for you, and you'll hear what they're doing. And it's free. I'm Dan Frizzell for the Washington State House Democrats, putting people first since 1889, the same year the first trainload of fresh oranges headed out of Los Angeles, bound for the East Coast on the Transcontinental Railroad. Thanks for listening.